Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Elliot Mintzberg of People for the American Way, who assesses the testimony of Supreme Court nominee John Roberts and the strategy of groups opposing his confirmation. Journalist and author Ross Gelbspan, who examines the connection between global warming and the destructive power of Hurricane Katrina and other powerful hurricanes seen in recent years. And Cindy Sheehan and Ann Rossler of the Bring Them Home Now bus tour, who recently urged a crowd in New Haven, Connecticut, to come to Washington for the September 24th national protest against the war in Iraq. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In early September, Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold called for a flexible timetable for the pullout of U.S. troops from Iraq. Feingold suggested a December 31, 2006 target date. Feingold is the first prominent Democrat to call for a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. Other party leaders, like New York Senator Hillary Clinton, have attacked the idea of a pullout date as a green light to the terrorists. In fact, Clinton, a leading candidate for president in 2008, wants to increase the ranks of the U.S. Army by 80,000 soldiers. A recent Associated Press poll shows 58% of Americans believe the war in Iraq was a mistake but are still reluctant to pull out the troops. Despite the growing unease with the Iraq war, Feingold remains one of the few anti-war voices amongst Democrats. According to The Nation magazine, the liberal hawks in Congress automatically get the strong backing of pundits like the centrist Brookings Institution, the New Republic's Peter Burnett, and Tom Friedman of the New York Times. The overt political strategy is to show the Democrats are tougher on defense issues than Bush Republicans. Former presidential candidate Gary Hart is one of the few dissenters. "It's a stupid policy," Hart observed. "Trying to get on the other side of the Republicans is folly." The Grist, an online environmental magazine, reports eco-justice activists are up in arms over a Federal Environmental Protection Agency policy draft to redefine the mission of environmental justice programs. In the early 1990s, the environmental justice movement emerged out of an understanding that racial minorities and poor neighborhoods were the most impacted by toxic pollution. Key evidence of this included a 1992 National Law Journal study showing that Superfund polluters paid 50% lower fines in minority communities. The new Bush administration proposal removes the terms race and low income from the criteria used to identify environmental justice projects. Will Rostow, an attorney with the California-based Communities for a Better Environment, claims the revision will render the EPA's mission on environmental justice meaningless. Moreover, 70 members of Congress sent a letter to the EPA protesting the draft plan, stating that the removal of race as a factor in decision-making was a significant departure from existing environmental justice policies. Florida Congressman Alcee Hastings stated, "It isn't that the EPA doesn't know what problems exist. It is their unwillingness to do anything about it. Shame on them." DKT International, a U.S.-based family planning group, is taking the Bush administration to court over its new anti-prostitution policy. The new policy, adopted in June by the U.S. Agency for International Development, requires all non-governmental groups seeking grants in the U.S. or overseas to affirm a policy explicitly opposing prostitution and sex trafficking. Many groups working on HIV/AIDS fear the policy will harm efforts to stem the pandemic. In the lawsuit filed in mid-August in Washington, D.C., DKT says the policy violates its First Amendment rights and hurts programs to combat AIDS. The organization runs social marketing programs on family planning and AIDS in 11 nations in the developing world and serves just under 10 million couples. DKT has already lost a U.S. aid contract in Vietnam by refusing to sign on to the new anti-prostitution policy. The suit seeks injunctive relief so the group can continue its work. In May, Brazil rejected a $40 million U.S. grant because of a similar anti-prostitution policy from the Bush administration. Philip D. Harvey, DKT's international president, in pressing the lawsuit stated, "Such a policy stigmatizes the very people we are trying to help. It requires us to condemn what sex workers do for a living, thus undermining the trust and mutual respect required to effectively conduct AIDS prevention work." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
With the end of Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearings on the nomination of John Roberts to become the next Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, most pundits and politicians predict the smooth-talking Roberts will have an easy time gaining approval from the GOP-controlled Senate. But opponents of the Roberts nomination are angry and frustrated with the federal judge's evasive and non-responsive answers to many important questions posed to him during the hearings. National Organization for Women President Kim Gandy said, quote, "As a lawyer, I have been listening very carefully, and what I've heard is a very clever attorney who has avoided answering many key questions by filibustering and doing the testimonial equivalent of reading the phone book," end quote. Groups urging senators to vote against Roberts' confirmation say that precedent-setting decisions on the issues of abortion, civil liberties, voting rights, consumer rights, and environmental protection may well be reversed if President Bush's nominee becomes Chief Justice, replacing the late William Rehnquist. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Elliot Mintzberg, Vice President and Legal Director with People for the American Way, a key group opposing Roberts' nomination. Mintzberg assesses the testimony and record of John Roberts, as well as the fight ahead to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor.
There's no question that Roberts showed tremendous legal skill and charm, frankly, in answering questions before the Senate Judiciary Committee. But what was most disturbing was his absolute refusal to answer questions about his views on past Supreme Court issues, about a little bit of more information on the right to privacy, critical questions that justices like Breyer and Ginsburg have answered when they were asked, and his simple refusal to do so, plus his refusal to really give the senators any kind of picture about what he's going to do in the close cases. He keeps on talking about the rule of law, which I, as a lawyer, very much agree with. But we know very well that in the close cases, the ones where you have judges and justices on both sides, that judges' values, their views of constitutional history, principle, these things come into play, and Roberts really refused to give any indication on those questions, which is extremely troubling. Given that, there was a limit, frankly, to what senators could do. I would have liked more attempts, frankly, to push Roberts to the wall on some of the issues, but it's understandable that senators felt, after he refused more than 100 times to answer questions, that it was not very worthwhile to continue to try to do that. But I think senators generally tried to probe on the Democratic side, and Senator Specter, I think the rest of the senators, the Republicans, clearly their job was to defend John Roberts, and they did that as much as they possibly could.
Elliot Mintzberg, of all the very big issues that will be coming before the Supreme Court in the coming years, and of course, John Roberts, being a relatively young man, is expected to be there for several decades, what are you most concerned about in terms of the case law that's already been set down and the possibility for overturning some basic codes that we've been following here as a country for many years?
Well, it's hard to pick just one, to be absolutely honest, because there are so many issues that the court is so closely divided on. If I can pick a couple, I guess I would say the authority of Congress to pass laws that protect our civil rights, our health, our environment, our safety, which we now know to be that much more important in the wake of the terrible tragedy of Hurricane Katrina, and the issue of the right to privacy, including not only reproductive choice, but end-of-life decisions and so many decisions that will need to be made as we move into the brave new world of the future. Roberts, again, was really pretty unresponsive on those. He acknowledged, in a very general way, a right of privacy under the Constitution, but basically used the exact same language as Clarence Thomas did, who has proceeded to vote against a right to privacy in a number of cases since then. And really, even though he's written at least one opinion on this congressional power issue, said very little to elucidate his views on that either. He wrote a dissent in which he strongly suggested that the Endangered Species Act, an important environmental law, may be unconstitutional as applied to a case in California. And other than his saying, gee, I didn't go as far as I could have in that dissent, we found out very little. And these are issues that are going to be critical in the future because the Rehnquist Court has already cut back privacy in a lot of ways and has overturned numerous important federal laws, at least as they relate to state employees, things like the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Age Discrimination Law, the Violence Against Women Act, many, many examples. And to see the court continue that trend under a Chief Justice Roberts could be dangerous indeed.
What is your group's strategy in terms of confronting this situation where a lot of the media pundits are saying, hey, this guy's a shoo-in. There's no way that Democrats who differ with him substantively on the issues are going to be able to stop this guy.
Well, there's no question that there's an uphill struggle, but we are trying very hard to convince as many senators, Democrats, and some progressive Republicans to vote no on Roberts, including on the issue of the refusal to answer questions and to produce documents. Because if you don't, if Democrats lay down and say Roberts is fine with us despite this, what happens the next time when we're replacing Sandra Day O'Connor? An even more critical swing vote in many ways, and you have a nominee with a scant record who, again, refuses to say what he or she thinks on a range of issues. You'd set a standard that would essentially eliminate any meaningful advice and consent. So I think our argument very strongly is a message needs to be sent to the president that this is not acceptable. Democrats, I think, are unlikely to choose to filibuster this nominee because of his particularly superb qualifications and because he's replacing Rehnquist, who is already pretty conservative. And to say we don't support someone like this to be the most powerful judge in our country for the rest of his life is an important message to send, particularly if, as many fear, we will begin to see decisions from a potential Roberts court that could be damaging to many of those interests.
That was Elliot Mintzberg, Vice President and Legal Director with People for the American Way. Contact the group by calling area code 202-467-4999 or visit their website at www.pfaw.org. In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, it's more than just the levees around New Orleans that broke. The social compact Americans assumed would protect them from disaster was also shattered. The destruction of most of the wetlands in the Gulf of Mexico, which used to buffer cities from the worst flooding a hurricane could inflict, now intensifies the destructive force of hurricanes along the coastline. Less directly apparent was the connection between the destruction wrought by Hurricane Katrina and global climate change. But that connection is being made by increasing numbers of scientists and other experts researching the subject. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ross Gelbspan, a veteran journalist and author of two books on global warming. He describes some of the hurricane-related phenomena that can and cannot be attributed to global warming and lays out what governments are doing to reduce the effects of global warming and the conspicuous inaction of the U.S. government under the Bush administration.
First of all, global warming does not make more hurricanes. There's absolutely no correlation between the frequency of hurricanes and the heating of the atmosphere. But there's very strong evidence that global warming makes hurricanes much more intense, and that's because they take their energy from the temperature of surface waters. That's basically their fuel. And if you remember, when Katrina began, it sort of glanced off South Florida, and it was a very weak hurricane. I think it had 70-mile-an-hour winds, even though it did kill six people. And then when it moved over these superheated waters of the Gulf, which were in the high 80s Fahrenheit, it went from 70 miles an hour up to close to 170 or 160 miles an hour. And that is very, very much due to these rising ocean surface temperatures. It's ironic that about a month before Katrina hit, there was a study published by an MIT researcher named Kerry Emanuel, and he found that all over the world, tropical storms have become 50% more intense since the mid-1970s because of warming surface waters and also warming-driven changes in wind patterns. And it's interesting now because in the wake of Katrina, there's somewhat of a controversy over this, but the intensity of Katrina and its relationship to global warming has been made by Sir David King, who is Tony Blair's science advisor. It's been made by the Deputy Prime Minister in Britain. It's been made by a conservative candidate in Germany and a number of other people. So it really seems, again, like as I say, it's not frequency of hurricanes, but intensity of hurricanes do seem to be linked. And in fact, if you go back 10 years to the 1995 report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which includes the work of about 2,000 scientists from 100 countries, more intense hurricanes and more severe storms is one of their projections.
The skeptics say that these extreme weather events are still within the natural range of climate cycles. Weather is nothing if not changeable, and even climate has a lot of natural variations. So how can you say that the increase in hurricane intensity is related to global warming? How do we know that, and at what point can we say we know that?
The reason we know that a lot of the weather events that we're seeing are related to global warming has to do with the amount of heat being trapped into the Earth. And there was a very important scientific study from some NASA scientists out recently that said that recently the Earth has become a net importer of heat. Prior to that, through most of prehistory, Earth has sort of been in a thermal balance. But with the buildup of greenhouse gases, primarily carbon dioxide, it has become a net importer of heat. This warming is expressing itself, and this is according to the scientific community, in more protracted droughts, more frequent heat waves, more severe storms, and the fact that we're getting much more of our rain and snow in these intense, severe downpours. So put in that context, Katrina seems very definitely linked to what we're seeing.
It's pretty amazing and discouraging that at this point in time, Congress has passed an energy bill with virtually no increase at all in CAFE standards to raise gas mileage, while it's obvious that that would have a huge impact on, you know, dealing with global warming. Do you think that this hurricane and the aftermath and the president's plunging popularity will push the administration and or the Congress to do something about that?
Your question about whether the impact of Katrina will make a difference in the political climate, I think really depends on the media making this connection. So far, I've been discouraged that the connection between emissions from cars and emissions from power plants hasn't really been made with the intensity of this storm. It's been made in certain places, perhaps more than I expected, but not enough, I think, to fuel the kind of political change that you're talking about that would really cause a large tightening of CAFE standards and other energy efficiency measures and so forth.
Russ Gelbspan, many cities and states in the U.S. are taking leadership in reducing their own greenhouse gases and even committing to the goals of the Kyoto Treaty, while, of course, the Bush administration has rejected the treaty, saying it would be bad for business.
It's really interesting because most of the real active work that's going on climate stuff in the United States is happening at the state and grassroots level. There are a lot of locally based climate active groups, and they're much more aggressive and much less compromising in a certain way than some of the major environmental groups. Even at the state level, they are doing state climate plans. You also had a recent meeting of, I think it was a conference of mayors, in which you had 132 mayors of American cities committing their cities to meet Kyoto standards. So whatever action is happening in the United States is happening at the local and state level, and it's really happening in direct opposition to Bush's lack of leadership.
That was journalist and author Ross Gelbspan. His two books on global warming are titled The Heat Is On and Boiling Point. Visit Gelbspan's website at www.heatisonline.org. After her month-long anti-war vigil in front of President Bush's Crawford, Texas ranch, which drew rare national media attention to the peace movement, Cindy Sheehan and her allies have hit the road in a 51-city, 28-state bus tour. The Bring Them Home Now tour, organized by Sheehan's Gold Star Families for Peace, Military Families Speak Out, and Iraq Veterans Against the War, have three buses crisscrossing the nation in advance of what's expected to be a massive rally against the Iraq War in Washington, D.C. on September 24th. At a stop in New Haven, Connecticut on September 18th, Sheehan, whose son Casey was killed in Iraq last year, and others on the tour addressed a crowd of about 1,000 opponents of the war on the city's historic green. Military Families Speak Out member Ann Rosler of Saratoga, California, whose son is in his third Army deployment in Iraq, spoke at the rally about why she opposes the war.
When I asked my son before he left what he would say to somebody who asked him what his mission was, he said, "Mom, I don't know." He said, "I haven't known for a long time. All I know is that when I get on the ground over there, it's my life or theirs." This is what our government is sending our soldiers to do. It's sending them over there to kill people in order to protect themselves. My son has said, "I don't want to put any more kids in body bags in order to line certain people's pockets with money. It's blood money." We are creating two societies of people who hate each other. And for what? We are fueling terrorism around the world. We're not doing anything to quell it. In my son's second deployment, he said he shot more rounds and killed more people than he had during the entire invasion, during the entire year that he was there the first time. I'm often asked why I speak out, how my son feels about it. And my son has often said to me, "Mom, we give up our rights to freedom of speech and a lot of things when we go into the military, and we do them ostensibly to protect yours." He said, "You need to be speaking out. We need to speak out and honor all of those who are in uniform and who can't speak out, because they're in uniform and they're silenced because they're concerned about the repercussions, or because they will never speak out again because they're no longer walking among the living. The best thing that we can do is speak out, speak loud, speak clearly every chance we get. And that's what I'm here today to ask all of you to do. Come to Washington, D.C., speak out, speak loudly, speak clearly, and don't stop until we bring them all home. We need to take care of them when they get here and never, ever let this happen again. Thank you."
Cindy Sheehan concluded the New Haven rally by thanking President Bush for his decision not to meet with her while she sat in front of his ranch, and urged those opposed to the war to come to the Washington protest.
You know, there Bush and his administration are always talking about unintended consequences. They didn't anticipate an insurgency in Iraq. They couldn't anticipate the levees breaking, although they've been compromised for decades. You know, they have all these unanticipated consequences, unintended consequences. But you know what? When George didn't meet with me on August 6th, this is his unintended consequence. Thank you, George Bush, for not meeting with me. But you know what now, George Bush? Instead of one person wanting these answers, we have millions of Americans that want the same answers, and we're not shutting up till you give them to us. And you know why I sat in the ditch on August 6th? Because I knew the media was not doing their job to be checks and balances on this government. I knew Congress was not doing their job. And I certainly know George Bush is not doing his job. You know, he's so worried about the Constitution in Iraq. Has he ever read our Constitution? We have one of those things, too. Now, we have all done an amazing thing for America, and we're committed to keep going until our troops are brought home, and after that, to make sure this never happens again for the young people who are here, for our unborn grandchildren and born grandchildren. We're committed to working, I am, for the rest of my life for peace. There's one thing we're asking you, is to come to Washington, D.C. on September 24th and be counted. We have to show the media that we mean business. We have to show Congress that we mean business. And we have to show this administration that we mean business and we're not going away. George Bush misunderestimated me when he didn't come out and talk to me. So really, we're not accepting any excuses for you not being in Washington, D.C. on the 24th. And I just want to tell you, it's not going to be a sacrifice because it's going to be the most amazing event in history. And I always talk like that. It's going to be the most amazing event like it in history. And if you don't go, you're going to be sorry. You're going to be sorry you don't go. And we have to have 5 million people there, so the media will say we at least have 500,000. So you'll read in your paper tomorrow that there was a couple hundred people here today. I don't know. I'm seeing at least 1,000. Thank you so much. Thank you, Connecticut. See you in D.C. next week. I love you. I love you. Thank you. Thank you.
For more information on the Sheehan-inspired anti-war bus tour, visit their website at www.bringthemhomenow.org. Protests, lobbying, and nonviolent civil disobedience against the Iraq War are scheduled for September 24th through the 26th in Washington, D.C. For details, call area code 212-868-5545. Or visit the United for Peace and Justice website at www.unitedforpeace.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Banzari.